Good morning. This is Jim Colburn of Commodity Research Group. I'm with Andy LeBeau, also of Commodity Research Group, and we're here to talk about energy markets. To learn more about us, you can check out our website at commodityresearchgroup.com. We would like to thank our friends at EKT Interactive Oil and Gas Training for hosting this podcast. Check out their newsletters, podcasts, and learning modules at ektinteractive.com. This podcast should be construed as market commentary, merely observing economic, political, and market conditions, and is not intended to refer to or endorse any specific trading system, strategy, or recommendation. We are not responsible for trading decisions taken by anyone. Information is not guaranteed to be accurate. This is not an offer to buy or sell any derivative. Today is we're the morning of April 17th, Wednesday. Good morning, Andy LeBeau.
Good morning, Jim Colbert.
We've had a little activity in the oil markets, but maybe not where you might expect. Why don't we start off with, just talking about what happened over the weekend from maybe a perspective of price action?
Okay. Well, let's talk about what happened on the most recent Friday here, which I guess would have been April 12th. And there, the trading community was presented with a number of headlines coming from all over the wires and all over social media and everything else about Iran's attack on Israel was imminent, and that the U.S. was warning Israel that this attack could come at any moment. The Israelis, obviously went into a defensive mode, but what the market did, it also went into a defensive mode, saying that the market went into a defensive mode with short covering and maybe some fresh buying that took us up to the highs of, nearly 88 basis WTI, 6 month highs. As we all know now, the Iranian attack on Israel was deflected. Some great defense by the Israelis, the Jordanians, and the U.S. And luckily, there was no damage. I think the attack had been certainly, well advertised. But nevertheless, and on Monday and into this week, we've seen the market come off pretty broadly from those highs back into the mid 80s. I think it's like 84.50 as we speak.
So if there was a sea of tranquility in this market, I mean, I'm an options guy. I think I saw it in the flat price. I mean, we kind of a raising of tensions as a major bombing would do, the price basically moved relatively sideways after a run up. I mean, it hasn't come down sharply, but it's really, when we look at this from an options perspective, we see that the implied volatility is running around 30%, which is, below average. Give the average around 33% long term. There is a premium in that, though, because the actual historical volatility 20-day is 16%, and that's a extremely low number for oil. So you're talking about maybe a 14 point difference between implied and historical, and those things can be all over the place at times, but that's still pretty wide. We also saw this increase in tension. Where we really saw it was it showed up in the option skew. The option skew is the difference between an out of the money call volatility and an out of the money put volatility. It's the implied volatility is the number we get. We back into it from the Black-Scholes model, or like a Black-Scholes model. And when you're trading options on the same future, theoretically, they should all be trading at the same implied volatility because they're both priced off the same futures contract. However, in real life, the tendency in oil is for puts to trade over calls. So that would indicate oil producers buying puts more than oil end users buying calls. So basically the paper flow or the order flow tends to be a put buyer call seller. So you get this normal skew of put volatility over call. So it flipped. And so we went from, maybe minus four where if I say the call out of the money call volatility versus out of the money put volatility is minus four, that means puts are 4 points over the calls. So it went from minus four to around plus 12 where it is now. So even though the prices were moving relatively, ranges were modest going into this thing and coming out of it, that was an indication that something serious is going on in the option world. So the other thing was that we would expect to see is heavy call volume, and we did see that. Even the day after Monday, we saw over 500,000 Brent and WTI calls trade, mostly volumes in Brent these days, and that's what you would expect. Open interest was up. However, what you saw Monday was also position moving around. So some of the options were showing a decline in open interest, and some were showing an increase, and a lot of spreads were being done. So that was like positioning, repositioning, and there's outright call buying as well. So even though the price movement might tell you that, tensions have abated in the option market, when we look at Monday and yesterday's activity, this market has still got major worry in it. So if I could look at some of the trades from yesterday in WTI, we started seeing, we haven't seen these in a while, but the $1 wide call spreads trading in size. So the SEP 100 101s were trading in size, 10,000 lots each. And you'd see an accompanying open interest move of about the same. New positions, SEP 93 and a half, 94 and a half, bunch of those traded. And we did see some DEIS 150 calls trade. So you're seeing these upside calls trading, and it's probably protection against, or maybe it's a speculator looking for increased, like a retaliation from Israel and for this war to escalate. However, we did see a bunch of June 90 calls trade, and open interest actually went down in those. So that's kind of like a roll, some people getting out, some people getting in. So that, again, I probably, the surprise to me was that maybe implied vol didn't go up higher. Everything that happened in options would be expected given the imminent, bombing that was widely reported, as you said, higher call, lots of call volume trading, vols move up, and the skew flips from negative to positive. So no real news there. The only thing that I was surprised is that we didn't see implied vol go up higher. I mean, during the Ukrainian invasion, vols got up to 80. You did have an accompanying price move with that. This time we get no price move. And again, I point to the 20-day historical of around 16% that kept the increase in vol muted. And having said that, we were at a low of around 23.5% late March, which was probably overdone anyway. But, all year we've been talking about a balanced oil market. And so it's hard to generate volatility when supply demand are in balance. So 30%, well, looking at long-term average, doesn't look high when you compare it to where we were, 23.5 or the 20-day historical. It's got a premium built in there.
Well, I think the the late March lows, it was April 1st that Israel bombed the Syrian embassy and killed the Iranian general. So I think that, you know, that was the event that
no question
got Vol going. But I agree with you. I mean, 30% Vol is relatively low, given some of the stakes that
right.
could happen.
Yes.
But, you know, alternatively, the market's been living with, you know, some type of threat for supply cutoff since Russia invaded Ukraine. So it's been, you know, which was in 2022. And of course, in 2022, we saw a lot of dislocation. We did see some supplies reduced, but by the end of 2022, the market had normalized somewhat.
Yeah. I was wondering, you know, if we're talking about Iranian sanctions or sanctions on Iranian oil exports, you know, maybe, which is a possibility, is maybe the market saying, okay, well, we had sanctions on Russian oil and it's still making it to the market. And the other thing is, you know, you hate to say it, it's an election year. And the worst thing that the current president needs is a spike in oil and gas prices. I mean, so maybe they're trying to work on Israel's response rather than slapping on sanctions to oil experts. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that's right. A lot of the information coming out of all the usual think tanks, the usual suspects, are that we're really not going to enforce sanctions. I mean, sanctions exist. We're not really enforcing them. You know,
right,
they could tighten them further.
Right.
But I think it'll move more towards enforcement rather than tightening. Although Janet Yellen was talking about the potential for more sanctions, but I haven't agree with you. I think the administration doesn't want to see gasoline prices get out of control. They have rallied significantly. They're, as we speak, they're around 364, which is around where they were last year, actually, at this time. And last year, retail gasoline prices for regular in the U.S., you know, they got up into the 380s during the summer and then came off. I think, you know, certainly the administration doesn't want to see a four, you know, an average handle nationwide of four. I mean, California, they're well above that. But, you know, it seems like the $4 level is something that they want to try to avoid. Not that they want to see it go, you know, higher than here, but, you know, 360 in the 360, 370s, I think the American consumer can handle that. And I don't think there'll be that much political blowback.
Right. It's really interesting. You know, Andy, when you first got into analyzing oil markets, I was in diapers. not quite, but you, I mean, you were one of the earliest ones because you picked up on the heating oil contract and you know,
yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Right. So you have been doing this for a long time. And when you first came into this thing, you know, a big driver of oil prices was figuring out what Saudi policy was going to be. And this many years later, when we look at all the stuff going on in the Middle East and we look at, you know, supply demand and all the politics, you know, what does it get down to again?
It gets down to the same thing.
Same thing.
What are the Saudis going to do? Because they are, you know, they are the swing producer. A lot of people have talked about the U.S. becoming the swing producer, but we're not, because our policy more or less is driven by a number of independent producers, independent majors or mini majors, whatever you want to call them. You know, we don't have an oil policy that's going to cut output like the Saudis do, cut and increase output, nor do we have the spare capacity that the Saudis do. So, you know, what they decide to do coming up, and we'll talk about that, you know, is going to be a critical determinant for price. And it really is remarkable through all these decades that they still have inordinate power over the price of crude, as much as many observers have said, oh no, the Saudis don't run the market anymore. Well, they do.
Right. And the other thing that's gone on in the last week or so is that the big three oil reports have come out, the monthly oil reports. And I think a couple of them suggest that OPEC is going to keep production where it is to the end of the year and then release some oil. Now, that's their assumptions and their base case. But why don't we talk about those three reports that came out? And is there anything that stands out to you that you want to lead off with in the IEA, EIA, or OPEC's reports?
Yeah, what stands out to me is that in the second half of the year, for all the reports, the call on OPEC crude is higher than their current production. And what does that mean? That means that in order to prevent inventories from drawing further and tightening up the market further, we're going to need more barrels from OPEC and OPEC and OPEC Plus. In fact, if you look at let's look at the IEA. Well, the IEA is saying the call on OPEC crude, for instance, is 27.3 million barrels a day in the third quarter, and they're producing 26.5 million barrels a day in the fourth quarter. They're looking at a call of 28.3. So again, that's a big draw. OPEC itself, and this is interesting, they have unbelievably strong demand this year. They're looking for demand to be up 2.2 million barrels a day, which is, I don't know. I mean, we'll talk about the CRG numbers.
Yes.
But OPEC, that's a huge amount. The IEA is like up 1.3 and the EIA is up 1. So really OPEC is, they're talking their book to a certain extent, obviously. But their call on OPEC crude, they've got draws. If there's no OPEC increase, OPEC plus increase,
mm-hmm.
they've got draws of 1.6 in the third quarter and 1.3 million barrels a day in the fourth quarter. So, I mean, those are big numbers. And, we look where inventories are now. They're not high. They're below average. I think if you look at inventories, on land inventories, according to the IEA, are low. They're as low as they've been since 2016. To counterbalance that, on water inventories are high. So one has to presume that, we'll see that those waterborne barrels unload, and that may lessen the tightness on land inventories. So here we are, we've got low inventories and we have a chance for pretty healthy draws in the second half of the year. We're looking for, we've got a call on OPEC crude of 27.3 million barrels a day and 27.4 in the fourth quarter. So let's say 27.4. Again, in order to balance stocks, we're going to need an extra 700,000 to 800,000 a day just to keep stocks level.
Mm.
And the question is, are we going to get that? And our numbers at CRG, we've got demand up 1.3 million barrels a day. It could be higher than that, actually. If you look at, some of the IMF yesterday increased their call for GDP. Jim, you were talking about what the Atlantic, global GDP. Jim, right. You were talking about what the Atlanta Fed was saying.
Yes, Atlanta Fed is up to 2.9% for the first quarter GDP. And that's, it's up. It's been, that's very strong, basically, for this economy. And,
for U.S.
Yeah, for the U.S., yes. Yeah. And so the the economists in the U.S. have continually lowballed their their numbers are just lower, and the sort of the Atlanta Fed is data driven. No, there's no opinions in there except when they make the model, but they've been consistently over the economist consensus, and the Atlanta Fed's been right at least recently. I don't know about long term, but anyway, there's good growth in the world, so you're going to get you could get more demand than you expect than what's built into this. These numbers, right? So what does that translate to in a price, Andy? I see the
let's get back to the Saudis now.
Okay.
So where are we going to get, let's be conservative and say it's 500,000 to 1 million barrels a day in the second half of the year. You know, who's got the spare capacity? Well, guess what? You know, it's Saudi.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Russia will have some. I think their production, you know, it's hard to say, but it looks like their production may be down some in the second quarter because of the attacks, the drone attacks on their refinery capacity. They have trouble with, they have some tightness on crude storage, so they probably have had to cut production. But nevertheless, most of the spare capacity is held by Saudi. So we have a June 1st OPEC meeting, and that's going to be a barn burner. Because it's a question of, you know, what price? What's the price going to be? Because clearly, if, and this is assuming no supply cutoff from the Middle East, you know, how anxious will the Saudis be? You know, what price do they want? You know, I think if there's no increase, prices could go, you know, WTI has a chance to go into the mid 90s, maybe 100. If they do increase and how they increase, you know, maybe the market gets down under 80, you know, and settles down, you know, settles down some. So. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask you if you have a risk premium built into your price.
You just laid me up. Yeah, let's talk about that risk premium.
I just hit a button for people who are listening.
You just did. All right. Do I have a risk premium into the price? Well, you know, yeah, there's a little risk premium, but as you and I have been talking about, we see often in the press some of some other analysts and traders and market observers throw numbers out like, oh yeah, there's a $7 to $10 risk premium in the market, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always amazed. Okay, that means that you know the equilibrium price, because the risk premium is over the equilibrium price. So, you know, how could you possibly quantify? No one really, people have been in search of the equilibrium price probably since, you know, oil was discovered in Pennsylvania in the mid 19th century. So, you know, if you've got if you know the equilibrium price and you want to add some numbers on, that's nice. But
yes.
I don't know how you can possibly do that.
I think the financial equivalent is R star, whether that interest rate non inflationary, but keeps unemployment down. It's what the Fed is supposed to be searching for.
Right.
But yeah, it's unknowable basically.
It's unknowable. Now the market can trade. You know, we've seen over our careers, obviously, that the market trades in a relatively narrow range, and at that point, you could say, all right. You know, this range, somewhere around this range, is for a long time, trades in a narrow range for a long time.
Right.
There were years during our career where it traded in like a $4 range, which is, incomprehensible to traders now, but, you know, go take out a chart in the 80s and 90s and you'll see years.
Well, I remember doing option classes where all of my examples were based on $18, and in order to change, you know, to keep it current, I'd have to, you know, change a lot, but I kept it at 18 for a long time, and then eventually had to bump it up to, I think I didn't bump it up to like 50. And if I was doing it today, I would probably put it around 75. So
yeah.
But interesting.
Well, I think the 10-year average for WTI is 65. So right. The last 10 years. So is that the equilibrium price?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know.
Well, you know, I pressed your button. One of my buttons to press is the mean reversion strategies. I think that's, you know, it's basically, in my mind, it's a short vol trade, which is doomed. You know, it's the old idea of picking up nickels and dimes ahead of the steamroller, and someday you're going to trip and get run over. So, yeah, we have our... have we been doing this too long? Are we really those two guys in the balcony of the
we
show?
Might be, but I think we also have some good, you know, we do have the benefit of experience.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, it's just, yeah, there's a risk premium in embedded in the price, that's for sure. But, you know, I what the dollar number is to me is, you know, just like you said, it's unknowable.
Well, I have to say, Andy, since we're, files are dumping in my head right now because we mentioned some key words, but I'm just going to throw this out there. You know, I've done some guest lecturing at some of the top business schools on commodity markets and options and things like that. And I met with a bunch of students for one of the one of these top schools afterwards. And I was asked, you know, the guy said, you've been around this business a long time. He said, what's the common thread of, you know, trading situations that blow up? And I just blurted out and I said, well, seems to me it's a high concentration of MBAs and PhDs from Ivy League institutions. And so, yeah, we all have our biases, I guess. But right. Anyway, back to our story of...
Back to our story.
When you talk about the call on OPEC, in the IEA talked about the end of, I mean, in 2025, they said the OPEC plus call is going to be down 300,000. And they threw out a number of effective spare capacity at 6 million barrels, which would be the largest ever. Now it's really hard for anybody to look out 2025, but that's, I mean, are we, is that, to me, that says we got a price war ahead of us.
It's certainly possible. I question the 6 million barrels. I'm not exactly sure where they're getting that. You know, I guess they, Iran, Venezuela. Yeah, this spare capacity, you know, Iran, Venezuela, maybe. Iraq certainly has some, UAE a little, Kuwait, most of it is in Saudi. There's spare capacity, and then there's the spare capacity that can actually come to market pretty quickly. And the ones that are politically challenged obviously can't. So I don't know about the 6 million. But nevertheless, yeah, 25 right now is looking a lot more bearish than 24. We see that in the, you know, we do see that in the price. Although I would say that, you know, one would think if production is going to increase in the second half, then we should start seeing the, and that's, that of course is I'm not, you know, we don't know, but you would think that the curve would kind of flatten out, and it has. I mean, if you look at, like, I was just looking at July D's, for instance, on WTI, and you know, that's come off from, I think it's like 45 or 50 cents a month down to 30 cents a month, but it's still backwardated,
right?
You know, and because the market doesn't know either. You know, there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty coming up, not only about geopolitical, but clearly about the actual supply demand. You know,
is this a good time to talk about gas to diesel values? Because, I mean, gasoline seems to be...
It's always a good time to talk about the Widowmaker.
Well, it's, you know, I keep reading about how we're going to see like a decline in demand in gasoline first because of, you know, efficiencies in cars, hybrids, EV sales, and yet gasoline prices are doing pretty well relative to the rest of the complex.
Right. Some of that is, you know, I think that might be more supply driven than demand driven. Demand has been, it's been all right. You know, it's probably running plus or minus 50,000 a day over last year. We'll see when the final figures are in US, I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. But on the supply side, we did have a very heavy maintenance period, which is now coming to an end. We also had a number of refinery issues over the winter on freeze-outs and operational issues, and we're still having them. So we really haven't seen gasoline yields get to where they should be this time of year. They're still running a little bit light. And as a result, we've seen, you know, gasoline stocks come off pretty good. PADD 1 stocks are definitely low. We're seeing that in the cracks. You know, the cracks have actually, I thought the cracks were going to come off pretty hard as we maximize the gasoline output after turnarounds, but we're probably a couple of weeks away from that. I don't think gasoline is going to, you know, I do think the cracks are going to come off. I think for gasoline prices to really explode, it's going to have to be crude lead. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, watching the yields. Now, looking at Europe, Russia's had refinery issues, but, you know, their gasoline exports are only down. They're down less than 100,000 barrels a day. So that hasn't been all that big of a deal. And Europe has been exporting inventories, as I said, have declined in Europe. But, you know, alternatively, in the Gulf Coast, the U.S. Gulf Coast, gasoline is running well below where it is here. I think it's 12, 13, 14 cents under where it is in New York Harbor. So on the screen, I'm sorry. So I think it's probably, you know, these crack rallies, you know, is a little more supply oriented and some slightly more regionally oriented. And as I said, as we see runs and yields maximizing, I don't think demand's going to be strong enough to, you know, I don't think we're going to see any shortfall here whatsoever.
Andy, it's traditional to look at stock levels compared to the five-year average, but the five-year average still includes the COVID stocks.
Yeah.
Is everything looking a little tighter because we're comparing it to a five-year average?
Or crude actually looks, you know what? I have to tell you something. I took out COVID. They're so ridiculous. The numbers are so off.
Right.
That I just threw them out. Crude actually looks around normal. Maybe a little tighter than maybe a half day to a day supply below average. Diesel looks near normal. Gasoline slightly below normal, but nothing, you know, if you throw out the COVID year and just use, say, four-year averages, you know, 19, 21, 22, 23, you know, there's nothing really untoward in any of these numbers, you know, including total stocks. So yeah, maybe we are at equilibrium.
Well,
and let me just talk a little bit about diesel.
Yes, of course.
I think the one thing that is really globally, our refinery margins in the US are pretty good, and in Europe they're pretty good. They're not awesome, but they're, you know, they're good enough. Asia's not. I mean, Asia, the refinery margins are you know, mediocre to poor. Diesel's been a problem in Europe. China's runs have been pretty strong, and their exports have been high, and you know, it's definitely led to some softness in on the Asian markets. Maybe that'll tighten up because they're going into turnarounds right now. You know, April, May, June is when the Asian refiners take turnaround. So maybe that'll tighten up. But that's something to watch. And China in itself is interesting on diesel because, you know, their emphasis has now been on manufacturing. And manufacturing leads to higher use of diesel just to take the product away from the factory and then, you know, export it. However, I think what's counterbalancing that is that another big demand for diesel is on building, right?
Right.
Is you know, when you,
yep. Yep.
Yeah. So when you build, you know, when you're building apartment houses, you know, you're transporting goods to the complexes. And that, of course, as we know, is in a nosedive. So, you know, net, it doesn't look like Chinese diesel demand has really been growing that as much as it should. It, you know, and a lot of that, I think, is probably because of the property sector really being I think it's in a depression there.
It's interesting. The IEA shows China, if you take the world oil demand, 79% of the growth in 2023 was China.
Right.
And they expect 45% of the growth in 2024 to be China, and then only 27% in 2025. So it's kind of, you know, China's slowing down as the driver of oil demand. Still strong relative to, I mean, 27% is still a big share, but I guess India is coming on.
India is coming on. I will say this about the IEA's China demand. they came up with a huge number last year for Chinese demand. So
right.
I don't know. And also last year's growth, you had comps because 2022, you know, they were still in COVID lockdown.
Right.
So I don't know. I mean, I think Chinese demand, where the CRG numbers, we're actually close to the IEA. I think we've got like 350 to 400 Chinese. I thought maybe it could be a little bit higher, and a lot of that's jet, you know, because they're beginning to, they're traveling.
Right. I'm just picking some things here. When we look at non-OPEC plus production growth, it's become like a throwaway phrase. It's US, Canada, Brazil, Guyana.
Right. That's right.
Right. So, looking for.
That's what it is.
1.2 increase in 2024, up one in 2025. Do you like the U.S. production numbers that you've seen from these big three?
Well, yeah. The numbers have been so far this year sort of been, well, January was way down because of the freeze outs.
Right.
So, you know, that's going to put a drag on year-to-year growth. I think that if I'm not mistaken, the EIA has, we're at 13.1. I think they have crude up to 13.5 by November and December, which is, you know, I think that's certainly doable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not going to grow as fast as we did last year. But again, last year we had some you're getting the comps for 2022. But I think the message is we're still growing, and I think we're going to continue to grow, and maybe at a more rapid pace in 25, depending on where, you know, prices end out this year. And you also have, you know, as I've argued, you know, getting Exxon and Chevron Exxon buying Pioneer and Chevron buying Hess, that's going to make things even more efficient. And the difference between Exxon and Chevron producing relative to an independent producer producing is Exxon has great, you know, they have access to capital and at a much cheaper rate. So I think as we, you know, as they start consolidating those companies, I think we're going to see those majors really crank it out in 25 and into 26.
So basically you're saying their cost of production goes down relative to the previous entity.
Yeah,
that was producing.
Any of the independents, you know.
Right.
So I think 25. Yeah, there's a lot of bearish sentiment for 25.
For 25, yeah.
Yeah, for 25.
So let's talk about we talked about prices, but let's kind of summarize it. So you think we tighten up as the year unfolds, things get are more likely to tighten up than loosen up, and prices. We've had a little run up already, but you can see another run up into the mid 90s and maybe possibly $100 basis WTI.
Yeah, if there's no increase whatsoever, you know, the Saudis play hardball. Yeah, I think there's a chance into the 90s. 100, that could be a tough nut, but yeah, I could see that.
So you're the big event. So you think June 1 is a much more important meeting, or is it relative?
Yeah,
to
June 1's the whole thing, and I think in May, certainly there's a geopolitical environment that we're in, and my comments or my predictions are assuming no supply cutoff from the Middle East, because that'll change
obviously.
Everything, but.
Yep.
Obviously, right. But June 1, yeah, that's the big meeting. That's when they're going to be talking about, what they're doing for the second half, or at least for the third quarter. And, the way the market's trading, I think it kind of expects at least a small increase, that it's going to be a gradual unwind.
Right. And we'll continue to, like, when you have Iran, firing missiles into Israel, that's got to keep, I hate to use a risk preview, but it's got to keep you a little bit leery of selling this market aggressively.
Right.
So you may not get people coming in, to short, like speculators might back off and say, I need a higher. I'm just not going to sell this market, or if I do it, I'm going to buy puts or something like that. But so that may cause a little sort of drifting up as well, where you just have less people willing to sell this market in general. What else you want to talk about, Andy? We're kind of getting close to the end.
Yeah, here. I think we're getting close. Yeah, I mean it's.
Would you rather be a refiner or a producer right now?
I would rather be a producer right now, because there is, and we talked about this, there is going to be new refinery capacity coming onto the market. So, I think even in a growing demand, I think I'd rather be a producer.
Okay.
And the last thing, of course, we also have the administration has to make a decision on Venezuelan sanctions, and that's coming up Thursday. Today's Wednesday. So we'll see. My guess is that they try to punt a little bit, rather than do a hard sanction right now. They punt as long as they can, delay it.
Right.
Probably, when's the election? November.
Oh, ours or theirs. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, theirs is coming up in July. Yeah. I think it's July, so they may punt it till then. But we and that's the other thing to watch is gonna be the sweet sour differentials. The heavy crudes have been gaining because the Mexican crude exports have been lower because their refinery capacity is increasing. And Venice produces a heavy crude, so that could help Canadian producers, and we've got that new pipeline coming up. There's a lot going on.
Yeah,
there's certainly a lot of infrastructure stuff going on too.
Right, and we intend to focus where the headlines are, even
right, but in the background, there's tremendous amount going on, and then we haven't even mentioned the energy transition, which is it grabs every headline
Before we go, the IEA did say the OECD oil demand is expected to be down 60,000 barrels a day in 2024 and the same amount in 2025. So I mean, it's possible. Would you call that peak oil demand in OECD?
Possible.
Possible,
yeah,
right?
Definitely. It's possible. But, you know, at the same time, there's the EV vehicles are slumping. Volkswagen just had a terrible report on its EV sales. And we know that Tesla sales were down significantly in the first quarter. So there's definitely a, you know, some pushback coming from the consumer on price.
And, yeah, I think owning a hybrid, I think I just think that's a better, easier sale for most people. I just don't feel comfortable being 100% dependent on the grid. Like if for whatever reason I have to get the heck out of my house, I don't want to.
Yeah, what? The hybrids have their sales are booming.
Yeah, they're just
Toyota's doing great. They took a lot of. There was a lot of negativity on their investment in hybrid, and they're killing it right now.
Yeah, they made some kind of calculation that if we're going to have a shortage of these EV metals, we're going to get more bang for our buck through hybrids than through EVs. So. I think that CEO is gone now. I'm not sure, but it seems like he may have been onto something there. And yeah, I mean, you and I don't get paid by Toyota, but I have a Toyota hybrid, and it's we love it. So yeah, less gasoline, and like I said, not 100%. It's not a plug-in. It's not a plug-in hybrid. So
it's not a plug-in, right? Nope. You don't have to depend on the grid.
Okay, so covered all a lot right. of ground, Andy. Let's call it. So I'm looking for slightly higher. I'm going to be focused in on the June 1st meeting, and I'm going to look for some sideways to moving higher prices, even if the escalation in the Middle East cools off, if that's possible. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's May is going to be filled with trial balloons from OPEC Plus, but as we said earlier in the podcast, it's going to depend on where the Saudis want to go with this.
Yeah, it was interesting when we did get into this business early. The OPEC meetings were pretty quiet going into the meeting. You didn't get a lot of commentary. Now. There's a lot of chatter. You kind of get a consensus view from what's said before the meeting, as much as there's a lot more movement, I'd say, before the meeting is based on their commentary.
Yeah. Well, the social media.
Yes. Right. Sounds good. Okay, Andy.
All right, Jim.
Talk to you later.
Okay.